Paul said, that the law entered that sin might abound, and where sin doth abound, grace doth much more abound. And I guess I feel that one of our real problems in the church is to get the gospel and the law together, or to have the gospel whole. And we've just been talking about it in relation to the black presentation the last couple of hours. And I felt for a long time that the law, that if we faithful to what God has done in Christ for us, would require a couple of major shifts in the country, in the culture of the country, in our common life. One of the shifts would be in power. And I've talked about that in the last 2 or 3 weeks several times, that and the presence of the black community here speaks to that. Namely, I caricature it a bit by saying that the old white rich men run everything, and that in some sense the younger non-white women and the poor ought to have some voice, more voice than they have. And that in that sense, you could say that the fundamental problem in America is the problem of power. Who controls what? And it's very clear to me that the split between the black and the white will not be solved without a shift in the power. That is, without black people getting power. And that's probably the only thing that can be done. It's of great significance right now to help black people achieve power. That's kind of a major shift that's necessary. But a much more important problem in my way of looking at things is the substance of American life. It's not the power, who controls. It's who controls for the sake of what? What is our common life about? What does it mean to be human? Where do we spend our time? What do we do with our existence? And what is the real God of America? Now, there have been a lot of books coming out that have been dealing with this. And Reich's The Dreaming of America, Topless, Future Shock, Hacker, The End of the American Era, a colleague of mine, Gibson Winter, Being Free, Galbraith, The New Industrial State, George Grant, Technology and Empire, and Marcuse. You might put Skinner in there, Walden too, I don't know. But anyway, there's been a number of books, all of which I think are worth thinking about, some more, some less. And last week I talked about two of those, and I just wanted to review briefly what they said before getting into Marcuse, because the chief function of these books, I believe, is that they begin to help us ask the question about what the content of the law is. That is, either the law that drives us to our knees and to listen, or the law that is expressed in our obedience. They cause us to ask some real questions, I think, and that's really what I want to do today, is to ask the question about what the substance of America is. Hacker feels that America's lost its purpose. And in his book, The End of the American Era, it is the end of the American era. It began with the end of World War II. And it's really a book on process, which is a book which deals with control and with how it is that you get anything moving, rather than the end for which one might move. But I think what he says is correct, That is to say that America does not have any great purpose that it can use to organize its life and can use in order to discipline itself and to order itself for the sake of anything. That is to say, we don't know really. We've lost a great sense of mission in Vietnam, which would give us some reason for pursuing it. And it's very hard to establish our purpose there as being any great vocation, although it's still put in terms of self-determination for the South Vietnamese and so forth. The question is, what is it that we would pursue in such a way as a nation that there'd be some point to doing anything but consuming more and spending more and producing more things? What would it that would enlist us so that we would be willing to sacrifice and we would be willing to do something other than kind of serve what Hacker calls our individual feelings? Hacker says we simply have lost any sense of purpose, and so we serve everybody's individual wants and needs, and that will not get us anywhere. That is, it'll never produce a nation. He actually uses that. Without the sense of purpose, there's no nation. And I think it's right, probably. I really was very impressed recently in reading Tillich's third volume for the umpteenth time, but his notion of the history-bearing group, that one's being is in part the being of the group to which he belongs, whether it's the church or whether it's a town with a good baseball team, or that is one being goes up and down with those groups. I know how that happens in sports. I can hardly anymore listen to the end of a baseball game for my favorite team, you know, especially if they aren't having a good season and I expect them to lose. I can't go through that ego deflating process of having them lose the game in the ninth inning for the umpteenth time. At any rate, the point is that a great deal of the being of a person is related to the participation, and so it is that an empire, use the illustration of the Roman Empire and the British Empire, were energized by some sense of vocation. He says, other than just having power for the sake of power. And that's our problem, that we will be asserting ourselves throughout the whole world without any sense of mission, without any vocation. It will be power for the sake of power. At any rate, that's kind of Hacker's position. Now, Grant is a Canadian, George Grant, and in Technology and Empire, he says that our problem is due to the fact that, really due to the fact that we have virtually the same problem, namely we don't have any great sense of what it means to be faithful. And he attributes this to the Calvinistic influence in our Western culture, which established a transcendent God, and as a transcendent God, you can't reach him, you don't know him, he hasn't got substance. And so you relate to him in the Calvinistic tradition through a kind of moral striving activity for the sake of activity. Well, what's the content of that activity? And he picks up on Weber there and says that Weber speaks essentially correct, that people became associated with earning a living and saving money and investing money, and that was the motivation that got the capitalist system going. And that this moral striving or moral activity for the sake of something now has attached itself through technology, and the god of American culture is technology. So that we produce or create whatever we can create without asking what the end is. So if we can go to Mars, I fully expect we're going to Mars. We got the technology to go to Mars, we'll go to Mars. Without asking whether or not it's worth doing. So that technology is in control. And so I leave you with those books, both of which say that we have lost the sense of vocation or purpose, and that without that we can't hope to be much of a nation. And there'll be a period now in which we exert our power without knowing for the sake of what. It'll be more or less exertion of power for the sake of being powerful, but without any great sense of the meaning of that, except to maintain our power. Now Marcuse fits into this in that he's made an analysis of what's going on in American culture, why it is that we continue to consume, why it is we produce for the sake of consumption. It's a kind of Marxian analysis, comes out of, but it's also Freudian. As you are aware, I think Freud said that if you want a civilization, you will give up satisfying your desires, that is the kind of natural desires that you have for pleasure, for leisure, for enjoyment, for play. You will give them up in order to produce a society that satisfies the necessities of life. And it appears that you have no choice but to do that. Nobody wants to work, that's the reason. Didn't say nobody wants to work, particularly most of the kinds of work that that we have to do, and certainly most of the dreary jobs on assembly lines and that kind of thing, nobody really wants to do, and one only does it in order to get what he needs to satisfy his what you call necessities. And what Marcuse says is that after a while you get a civilization through technology which could satisfy the necessities without doing much work, but then you have this civilization and this productive enterprise, and it's going, and in order to keep going, it creates a kind of second nature. And that second nature, he actually at some point calls it biological. Second nature, which are the desires and wants that the productive enterprise creates. You've all heard this story, blaming the advertising and so forth, but this is the story at any rate. So you have the increasing or continued sublimation of what you would like to be if you were human, and the subordination of your life of play and imagination and beauty and so forth to work. You also have a sublimation of sex and a very careful control of sex. That is, in his interpretation of libido, it's a very broad term, and it would not have to do with what's so-called general reason, but there would be pleasure in bodily exercise and bodily contact, or quite apart from what we ordinarily think of as sexual, that is the genital areas. And he says the whole civilization has forced us to focus on those because they're controllable. And then it's given us all kinds of mores and so forth in order to control this, focus it, limit it, and therefore really get all the time that's needed in order to work. I mean, literally to carry on the life of our productive enterprises. That's kind of the way he sees the excessive sublimation, if necessary sublimation for the sake of the necessities of life. But what's happened is that in addition to what is necessary, we've gone on to, in the light of our increased technology, to sublimate what we don't need to. And this is the way in which the productive enterprise, the same kind of technology you see that Grant is talking about, is served. That is, it's a technological development and technological operation which establishes ends which are served by the people without their having much choice. And we think we have choice, but according to Marcuse, also according to Grant, and the same would be true of Galbraith in the New Industrial State, they're saying that the productive enterprise has created the want which serves it. And therefore it creates a problem. So the issue seems to be that if you take Marcuse's analysis, very attractive to me, that he's not saying that one should kind of find a way of finding meaning in work, and a lot of efforts have been made to find meaning in work. Just accept some of the work as drudgery and necessary, but that we accept work as necessary to fulfill wants which aren't really our wants. They are wants which have been produced in us by the mechanism which we have created to produce our necessities. But instead of just serving us in terms of necessities, that system has gone on to create all kinds of things that aren't necessary. And therefore the issue is what to do about it. Now Marcuse is a person who's been very influential in France. Student votes in France, this kind of analysis really very influential among some groups in this country. And he's an important person in the dialogue on basic kind of cultural analysis. He doesn't give much answer, doesn't pretend to, in terms of how you get any change. And if you begin to get into that, he talks about the problem as a coming out of the Marxist tradition. He talks about who the proletariat would be in our society. And he's very realistic because he recognizes that there are practically no proletariat in our society. That is, there's no group whose oppression is so obvious that they would be the vehicle for some social change. Since all of us, and you know, I'm the same way with my doubleness, blacks, and all this kind of stuff, all of us have been socialized to really desire these things, and so our standard of living is such that, and we've also achieved enough to do something about these things, so that we're all bound into the system. And there's no way out of it. I mean, there's no obvious way out of it because there's nobody who really isn't served by the system. There's so many people who are served. I mean, you take the blacks, you take them out, and you take some poor people out, but everybody else is maybe some old people. But for the most part, we don't have a big proletariat. We don't have a big group of people who are on the outside of the system. Now you can get some arguments about this, but I think he's right, essentially, that if you wanted to find a vehicle for change in which the substance were questioned, you have no vehicle. No vehicle for it. No group whose life is so wrapped up with it. That's why so many people who are dealing with these, Reich and all kinds of people who are dealing with this issue, talk about consciousness as the only vehicle. That is, to raise the level of consciousness so people are aware of this, talk about it, and begin to share with each other and discover more or less what is happening to them on the theory that this consciousness eventually will lead to some kind of social change. The other thing that doesn't occur in most of these is any real institutional, that is any sense of what it would look like if you were to change. Now, in our seminar in ecology, we had about 15 sessions. We did have 15 sessions, a couple of after sessions, but we were asking ourselves, how are you going to deal with the problem of pollution in our cities? And one person today said, one who worked on this problem for public utilities, said, well, within 5 years, he thought, a good many of our major cities would have mass transit programs underway, and automobiles would be forbidden in the major cities. But this would be the way we got at it. And we actually had an exercise in this room at one point in suggesting how you'd cut your budget 20-50%, particularly on the items that were involving pollution, which, you know, your cars and airplane travel, those jets we let loose a lot. And it was very hard for us to find ways of cutting anything that was very significant, at least we didn't get very far. So that I guess I have two real issues in mind in bringing Marcuse to you. One is the correctness of his analysis at the level, at least, of what's happened to us. When he begins to talk about what ought to happen to us, in a way, he ducks the issue and says that a very interesting passage where he's being asked this question. He talks a little about it. What it would mean to be human if we weren't engaged in all these things. He said he's talking about freedom is over against being bound into this system. He says the incentives would then be built into the instinctual structure of men. Their sensibility would register as biological reactions, the difference between the ugly and the beautiful, between calm and noise, tenderness and brutality, intelligence and stupidity, joy and fun, and it would correlate this distinction with that between freedom and servitude. Freud's last theoretical conception recognized the erotic instincts as work instincts, work for the creation of a sensuous environment. The social expression of the liberated work instinct is cooperation, which, grounded in solidarity, directs the organization of the realm of necessity and the development of the realm of freedom. And there is an answer to the question which troubles the minds of so many men of goodwill. What are the people in a free society going to do? The answer, which I believe strikes at the heart of the matter, was given by a young black girl. She said, "For the first time in our life, we shall be free to think about what we are going to do." And one of the suggestions I've made is that we think about coming up to Holden Village, you know, those who have some resources and could live with the standard of living here for a period of 3 or 4 years and live here 3 or 4 years, then you'd have to think about what you were going to do. Because you wouldn't ordinarily, you know, just automatically be plugged into the system. Well, that's kind of what I wanted to share with you, and maybe less Marcuse than Al Pitcher, but that's the way we do with what we read anyway, and maybe that's the most important way to treat it, although I think I spend most of my life trying to treat a book like Marcuse. I spent 6 weeks in one class on his Eros and Civilization and finding out what he says and why. Kind of today I'm responding to it, I think, in terms of the meaning of it for me. You mean without any way of moving toward this kind of... See, this is a kind of post-Marxianism. It comes out of the Marxian tradition. This whole school, it's built around the Frankfurt School. They began this kind of, you know, school of thought in 23, and it's been operating for a long time. It comes out of that tradition. Habermas is one of the recent ones there, in which there was to be a transformation of the society by changing the ownership. But you see, now he sees that there's no difference in Russia from here. The same substance, that's the issue, you see. Most of our changes have been changes in terms of who controls or who participates in control. But now he is asking the question, I think this is what makes it a significant book, saying that you don't need that. Now the one criticism you can really make of that, George Grant makes, I think it's the one criticism you can make of it in terms of the meaning of it, is that if we are as much troubled as we seem to be in terms of resources, maybe we won't have the technology to produce the way we have been, certainly not in many countries of the world, and therefore this is really utopian, even for us, because given the demand on minerals especially, with such short supply of them, our whole technology will shift. And then we may well have to rethink it. But I don't see how our technology would shift in the realm of agriculture. It seems to me we can provide food and clothing and housing, these necessities, under any conceivable technology, such that we would be freer than we have been from the necessity to spend so many hours, and especially the professional people, spend so many hours in production. It's like production of a college. To produce a college, you've got to work 60, 70, 80 hours a week, I know. And to get involved in the production of anything, or a career as a professor, you're involved in the same kind of thing. And the question is whether or not that production is really negative, as Marcuse thinks and as I think a good deal of the time, or whether you can justify some kinds of involvement in production and not others. But I'm really anxious for you to think. It is true, Mary, that none of these works has any solution. I mean, they don't, they just say, here's the problem for you. if you take this country, if you're in one of the developing countries, you can see the oppressed people as the vehicle for a shift. But there's no obvious group in this country that would be the bearers of any change. And as I ask the blacks, I'm not even sure that the blacks are the bearers of this kind of change. And this really is, you know, it's sometimes you think you're being very negative to say it, and you question whether you have a right to say it at this time in history. But this is the change that's crucial. And we can actually... There's two ways you can avoid this, I think, and be very responsible. One is to get on the minority bandwagon in this country. The other is to get on the have-not nation bandwagon and get them where we are. Help get them where we are. And maybe that's all we can do. Or maybe that's the only direction we can move. We could have as a national purpose the healing of the division in this nation and the bringing of all peoples into the American dream, or the raising of the standard of living of the rest of the world and the reduction of our standard of living for the sake of that. That would give us a national purpose. If it would give us some reason, because we get ourselves harnessed to that. I don't know how you get ourselves harnessed to that kind of purpose. We're 6% of the population, and the figure I heard was 50%. Other people have higher studies. We use 50% of the resources of the world for 6% of the population. And the 28 of our metals out of 38 are in short supply in this country. We're dependent on other countries. And the question is when they would shut those off, and therefore we would have to have a different kind of standard of living. Gas, they have 20 years. They're substitutes, more or less, for some of these. Oil's a little longer.
I would really question the premise that work is an even question. I talk to young people that are going back to the production of those necessities. They don't want to step in the third or fourth time. They want to be in the production mission. We find means from that. I think many of us are misplaced, or we think of work as nothing but drudgery. And dehumanize ourselves as well as what we invested in. Dehumanize as far as being involved in the perfunctory kinds of jobs rather than those to bring self-fulfillment. But I think many people that despise their jobs go home and work in the workshop at night and find great fulfillment from it. And I think it's a shame that they can't find that same fulfillment by choice of vocation during their 8 hours a day. I think that is the
Yeah, Mark, I think that's a good question as to whether, one is whether people are as unhappy as other people think they are in their work. I mean, I think sometimes we make other people unhappy because we think we would be unhappy in it. And the other is whether some of the meaning. I know I can find real meaning in some kind of work. The question is whether it's work that you have to do, kind of, or whether we define work as something you get paid for and that you have to do in order to participate in the economy. It'd be interesting to have an experiment with people who got their incomes, and then what would you do? And I think there are. I've always said that a lot of the women are in that boat, and I think they face the issue that we are facing here. Really, what do you do with your existence if you're free to do what you want with it? And I don't think that's an easy question to answer. And it isn't obvious that there's much of an answer for it. I mean, that somehow it's very difficult, it seems to me, to find something to do with your time when you've got all the time in the world. But I think it's probably be a good thing. So I'm agreeing with you and disagreeing with you, I think, Mark, because I just feel there have been a lot of people who have had free time and they haven't known what to do with it. As a matter of fact, some of them go out and get jobs because they don't know what to do with their existence when it's free and they've got a choice of doing anything. And I really think a lot of women either haven't had children or their children are gone and they've had that kind of freedom. Now, I know it's limited because if you're not in a professional world, and grow up to it, you're limited in terms of your freedom to participate, but still, if people I don't think just work, it really bugs me. I think about a lot of people, they don't seem to get joy out of doing. You and I may, but I think there are a lot of people who don't get joy just out of doing. How the rest of
it? Is that because of the fact that they have been deprived of the kind of a deepened education and permission to enjoy themselves in their youth, or is it because you think they just don't have what it takes to do it now, yourself?
Yeah, I don't know, Carol.
Okay, my own experience is a little bit different, but I think that I, one thing I think to my people, just the reason why that at the job every day, even if they like it, they just pay to be there. We'd be glad to be there, you know, or 4 months a year, but to do it consistently all the time, you know, just keep them. I think that's why you pay for it. Most jobs are that way.
Well, I don't know what I would do if I didn't have a job. Niebuhr always said that was common grace. You know, a job is like a family or something. It pulls you out of yourself to do something when you might well sink back in and become a vegetable. And I think there's some truth to that.
I think that's true, Carol. The experience I had, you know, I'm in a hike house and I make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and that to me is not fulfilling at all. One day I went out and I shoveled cement for the sauna pool out there, and I really, really felt good at the end of that day. Because I could feel that I was taking part in being, you know, what you call a village shaker. I was physically shaping the village. And so I think that there are some jobs where you cannot really see yourself saving anything. You don't see the end result, and even if you do, it doesn't really concern your life directly. Whereas shoveling for that sauna pool, you know, I really felt that I could use that and I could be a part of it and I was helping others.
What are we saying? Are we saying that a lot of the work we do is done just because we have to work for a living or something?
We only have part of the job. We don't see our job as a, it's only a part of the total job performance. And we're only performing a segment of that job. And this is what I think people find the glory.
What I think Marcuse is saying is we could work 20 hours a week. That's for money. That is, we could buy, if we would quit buying what we don't need, if we had a different style of life. And there might be many aspects to this. One of the things we were talking about in the ecology group was trying to set up a community like this we were talking about here. As we say, you wear your oldest clothes, and sometimes think you haven't got clothes old enough to fit in here. But clothes don't, I don't think they mean very much here. And so you don't have to buy any. Now think what you could say. Of course you don't need a car here. And there are a lot of things you don't need, but we were thinking about having some kind of a parish community. It sounds very utopian, but this is utopia in a way. Mm-hmm. But maybe it sets a pattern for some existences and I don't know what it means. You see, that's always the problem, because all the history of utopia is like this. very negative in terms of becoming a parent or anything. And immediately those of us who are institution minded say, well, how do you get this thing on a big enough scale to make any difference? Maybe you don't for other people, but maybe you do for some people. But if you don't for other people, then you're in real trouble, because it's not easy to fit into a whole culture. Now, Mao in China is trying to shape a whole culture. And it's very interesting to see, because I think he has learned from Russia that Russia is exactly like the United States. I mean, it changed. You got more bureaucracy and more problems of control there, because you got more irresponsible bureaucrats than we got. We got plenty of them. And so you got irresponsibility compounded there, and the same goals. And we just compete with each other, which, and of course, in any analysis would say that we use what? Some such great portions of our budget competing to get to the moon or Mars before the other one, and some other things just like that, which if you spent that money for other stuff, and of course in the ecology philosophy it would be for services, not things. Anyway, you could reduce, it seems to me, the time we spent working a great deal. And if you had styles of life which were different, but Sarah doesn't want to work 5 days a week, she'd be glad to work 3 or 4, and I think would enjoy the way, and because that's all I work anyway. So it's really hard to know how much I do. But at any rate, you get a lot of people who would change their stuff, but it's very hard in our system to change your stuff. Very hard. They may help some, Mary. I'd be very suspicious. I was part of the cooperative movement from the 30s on. I don't know how they're going to work. See, one of the things is we have 2 cars. It'd be nice if we didn't have 2 cars. I only drive 6 miles a day. If we could get our transportation system, something, so we could get, you know, all kinds of things need to be done institutionally, so we don't, I mean, look at all that insurance and investment and pollution and everything. Yeah, well, that was what Marcuse, of course, avoids by saying we'd have time to think about what we wanted to do, and then we could ask the question of what it means to be human.
I'm willing to say it was fun time. Because I like to have it and see what happens.
You know, my conclusion here is to take an example question from a South Pacific Island, an ideal place where the people are uneducated, they work very little, they don't wear many clothes, they don't have many possessions. So then we, civilized, goes in, civilized, bookings, goes in and says, no, you have to live, sit on chairs, you have to have one coat, all sorts of. You have to work and have products that you can sell to people, you can buy other things. Now here we're talking about the opposite of going backwards, at the same time we're going around trying to bring people up.
Yeah, I think it's somewhat of a problem, though, in terms of we are a tool. When we got to think about our society, kind of too, I'm not trying to be in isolation, but whatever, you know, maybe the South Sea Island, sounds nice. So does B.S. Skinner's Florida, too. So if you want peace of mind, that's true. But, and, you know, the problem is that we are living in a society and have to deal with ourselves in this society. What do we do? Not many societies are like that. So have as much as we can to rest it. And what are we going to do?
Yeah,
so
what
I'm not trying to take it to the South Sea Island. I'm trying to think about what I would do.
But I want to leave it there. But
Okay, so that might be, that might be a perfect illustration of what Mark Cruz is talking about. We got to get everybody to have the same wants we have, so we can sell them stuff.
Yeah, that's the point I'm going to make. It's our right to, you know, to same other people for which we don't find.
Well, the question is, do we have a right to bring up children who are socialized to want so much?
Capitalism is the most derided of the need. We're a capitalistic country. We've got to sell.
Yeah.
And who buys? We've got to get the customer.
Yeah.
That's
the place where we've got to have, even though we don't want it, we've got to do more taxes, have more intervention, and get more things away.
Well, we got a problem in terms of relations to other nations, but I think the best point is, what are we? And I don't even mean to anybody out of this room, but although in a sense we have to think institutionally, but I'd like to start where we are. What do we think about the kinds of consumption habits we have? And what would we really like to do about them? And is it conceivable that there are different patterns that could be discovered even within the present social system? Jim, you and Alice certainly have had a different kind of experience with this year. And what's going to happen when you go back to Minneapolis in terms of, I would really personally like to get a pattern of life in which we spent about half of what we do. And I don't know whether we can do that or not. And the problem is, how do you get roles then? I don't know how I can get a role. A colleague of mine is talking about going on halftime. How do you go on halftime? How do you really make this thing work so that you are, 9 months of the year working? That's all I work anyway. But anyway, you're only working part of the year and you're only working part of the week at things which earn a living. So then you're free. You may work harder. You've probably spent more hours up here, Jim, than you did at home. But you did it with a different sense, I suspect.